Welcome to the Christian Mysticism Podcast, where we explore the fascinating history of Christian mysticism from the early days of the church until today. I'm Alberto de la Cruz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Carlos Ayer, the T. Lawrison Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. Glad to have you back on, Carlos.
Hey, it's always good to be on. Thanks for setting all of this up and all the work you do for it. It's marvelous.
Well, it's my pleasure and my honor to do it, and I'd be lying to you if I told you I wasn't having fun doing this. And I know our listeners are enjoying it because we keep getting wonderful emails and questions that we try to answer, and we do appreciate your support. And if you really like the show, please click the like button. Please subscribe so you don't miss another episode. So last time, we talked about moving into a book that was inspirational to you, and that is a sort of a handbook.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
The book is The Imitation of Christ, which I guess nowadays could even be called a self-help book, a spiritual self-help book. It was written in the 15th century, not too long before the printing press was invented. Actually, at the National Library in Belgium, they have the manuscript written by the author himself. But the printing press was invented in 1450, and very soon thereafter, this was one of the first books ever to become a bestseller. Because, of course, before the printing press, you had to copy everything by hand. Here, they could just crank out the books. And not only was it a bestseller in the original Latin, but it was translated into so many different vernacular languages and so relatively quickly that it took over, basically, the devotional text market, even though it was very crowded. This was an era where many of the best sellers, and we have the statistics from the printing presses, we know. Devotional texts from the 15th century through the 17th century, devotional texts dominated the bestseller list. And that's so hard for us to imagine, but that's how it was. The Imitation of Christ is very widely regarded as one of the more important, if not among the most important, devotional texts of all time. And I looked it up today. There are statistics that say that it is the most widely read devotional work after the Bible. So it's number two. But I don't know how accurate those statistics are, and I don't know how old the statistics were. I have my doubts that it could still be that high on the list, but I think that if it's not number two, it's very high on the list.
So I understand this book was originally published without an author, but later on we found out who that author was.
Yes. It was published anonymously. As the author says in the text itself, I'm going to read a quote, his advice to the reader. Do not let the writer's authority or learning influence you, be it little or great. Let the love of pure truth attract you to read. Don't ask who said this, but pay attention to what is said. And he says that at the very beginning. His name was Thomas a Kempis, or sometimes just called Thomas Kempis, from the Low Countries. And he was involved with a community that was known as the modern devotion, the Devotio Moderna. And what was that? Well, that was a very mystically inclined movement for clergy and also for lay people. And out of the Devotio Moderna emerged a group known as the Brethren of the Common Life, and then also the Sisters of the Common Life, who ran schools and taught young people not only everything they needed to learn to make their way through the world, but also taught them the spiritual path that the Devotio Moderna was best known for. What was that? What was that spiritual path? It was to pay much, much more attention to what is going on inside you, in your heart, your mind, your soul, than to obsess over the externals of religion. So, as has his advice said, you know, don't worry about who's the author. Just pay attention to what is being said. And this was a movement that many experts think was part of an even larger movement in the 15th century, where lay people became interested in their religion much more intensely. But that intensity involved also many external trappings of religion, such as a certain number of masses for the dead being better than a lower number, and so on, and donating works of art to churches. The second half of the 15th century throughout Europe, it's just incredible the amount of money that began to pour into churches for decoration. It was a huge boom in the creation of sacred art. And the Devotio Moderna, you know, it didn't condemn that spending, but what they said basically was, you know, it's much more important to straighten out your life and to try to get close to God. Or in the case of this book, which reflects the Devotio Moderna, try to be more like Christ.
Tell us a little bit about Thomas a Kempis. Was he a monk, a priest, a layman?
He was a canon. Canons are hard to explain. You know, there's such a huge variety of monastic clergy. Canons normally were clergy who served a bishop, and they usually came from the wealthiest and most powerful families. And they were supposed to live a monastic lifestyle at the cathedral with the bishop. But other associations of canons started to be established. And Kempis was of the canons of Windesheim in the Low Countries. And a member of this very same community, Gerd Groot, is the one who really launched it into overdrive, so to speak, and made it a very potent force for change, not just locally, but it spread throughout Europe. And we don't know much more about him. And because the book was published anonymously and it was so popular, people began to make guesses. And in some places, such as in France and in Spain, he was not known for quite some time. As a matter of fact, in Spain, they thought that the book had been written by a Frenchman, Jean Gerson, who had been, is a prominent theologian, but also a very devout cleric. And he had been chancellor of the University of Paris. And in Spain, throughout the 16th century, the book was called El Gersoncito, the little Gerson. And no one knew about Thomas Kempis. So he sort of got what he wished in the first chapter of The Imitation of Christ, which is, yeah, don't pay attention to who the author is. I should add that this is also, you know, so important, a virtue, the virtue of humility for the Devotio Moderna, the canons of Windesheim, and The Imitation of Christ. Almost every page has something to say about humility and how important it is.
Now, the book was obviously an amazing success, second only to the Bible, and according to the statistics. Were there other books like this in that era? Did it start a trend, or was it part of a trend?
It was part of a trend. And yeah, this new intensity and devotion that appears in the 15th century, many similar books were produced. And not only were these books produced, but right after the invention of the printing press, they started to be published. So you have this development of this genre of devotional texts, which is like a mini tsunami, because in addition to all these books being published, there are constant efforts being made to translate them into languages that people can read. Or in some cases, if these devotional texts were written in some vernacular language, they're translated into Latin for the learned and for the clergy. So some of these books continued to be very popular. Some of them had tremendous influence on the development of mysticism in the 16th and 17th century. One of the earliest ones was a book called The Life of Christ by Ludolf of Saxony, written in the 14th century. This book, The Life of Christ, was not a biography of Christ. It was a series of meditations on the life of Christ, in many ways similar to The Imitation of Christ, right? Very Christ-centered. And the meditations were such that the reader was encouraged to imagine himself or herself in the time of Jesus, place themselves in scenes from the Gospels. For instance, to be there at the foot of the cross when Christ is crucified, and then, you know, to search your feelings and so on and so forth, or, you know, watching Jesus perform miracles. That book had a tremendous impact on St. Ignatius Loyola when he read it while he was convalescing from his horrific leg wound that he sustained in 1521. That book changed his life. It wasn't Kempis. It wasn't The Imitation of Christ. But The Imitation of Christ is very similar to Ludolf's Life of Christ. And then there were other writers, and sometimes they Latinized their names. There was Lanspergius from the 15th century. There was Louis de Blois, better known as Blosius, from the 16th century. There was also a Spanish cleric, a monk, Garcia de Cisneros. One of his cousins was actually the Archbishop of Toledo, the most powerful churchman in all of Spain, who wrote a book titled, well, the English translation is Exercises for the Spiritual Life, with, you know, very similar to Ludolf of Saxony, similar to The Imitation of Christ. And another book that was a bestseller, and actually, I suppose, if we had all the correct statistics, we might say they might have been really close to each other on any bestseller list, was The Spiritual Combat. That was the title, by Lorenzo Scupoli. And some of these books, like Ludolf of Saxony and the books by Blosius, they didn't exactly vanish after the 17th century, but they didn't have the same intense long life as The Imitation of Christ or The Spiritual Combat by Scupoli. And actually, I just remembered, Garcia de Cisneros' cousin, Cardinal Francisco Jimenez de Cisneros, who was a Franciscan, was very uncomfortable with the huge salary that he earned as Archbishop of Toledo, which made him one of the richest men in Spain. So he took his salary and, you know, he established a new university with his money, but he also sponsored a translation program. And many of these texts, the ones I've mentioned and many others, were translated into Spanish for the first time. And that's how Ignatius Loyola got to read Ludolf of Saxony. So you can say, no Francisco Jimenez de Cisneros, no translation program, no Spanish mysticism in the 16th century, not to the same intensity. So these devotional texts, the reason, you know, it's not a mystical text in the sense that, you know, it talks about ecstasies and visions and levels of closeness to God, you know, the triad of purgation, illumination, union. You won't find that in The Imitation of Christ. But it and other books similar to it were read by all of the major mystics along their way as entry points, in many cases, to the mystical life.
You can almost say it was a preparation manual.
Yes, I can certainly attest to the fact that it does work like that, for sure.
Preparing the mind and the spirit for the mystical experience.
Yes, which always requires, in every case, Christian mysticism, being self-effacing, right? Achieving some kind of attitude where instead of you being the center of things, God is the center of your life. And that's what The Imitation of Christ is all about, being self-effacing, which is what Christ was. That's what you have to imitate.
So tell us about the book.
Yeah, well, the book, it's not very long. Let me see, I've got a small version here. Let me see how many pages are in this edition. They're tiny pages, my edition. and it's 280 pages, small pages. It's divided into four sections, and its main theme is if you want to imitate Christ, which is the best thing you could ever do, you need to withdraw from the world and even withdraw from yourself. So it has a very stark dichotomy between the world, life in the world, and life of the spirit. The spiritual life, worldly life, are polar opposites in this book. And we must keep in mind, you know, when this book was written, this is when, the modern world was beginning to appear. And the economies in Europe were all growing very, very rapidly. And the number of rich people was growing. The middle class was expanding tremendously. So there was a certain amount, and here's a paradoxical juxtaposition. 15th century is known for all of this fervent devotion, but it's also a period of great worldliness. So it's a book written for its time. And this main theme, subdivided into four sections, there's a good deal of repetition, but this is also something that one has to keep in mind, that repetition was considered a very good thing in this day and age, especially in devotional texts. Repetition was a virtue, not a vice. I was taught, when grading students' papers and exams, that if they repeat themselves constantly, I have to keep bringing the grade down, right? Because they're not saying anything. They're saying the same thing over and over again, 45 different ways. But this was not a student paper. This is a devotional text, and repetition was a virtue. Book one of The Imitation is titled, and this is my translation, the one I used, Helpful Counsels of the Spiritual Life. And the book derives its name from something in the first chapter of book one. And I quote, "The imitation of Christ and contempt for the vanities of the world." There you go, right from the start, that you have to have contempt for the world. And before I start reading passages, I'll go through what the other books are. Book two is titled Directives for the Interior Life. Now, what could that be? This continues the theme of book one, and it is full of instructions about how to achieve, and I quote, inward peace. Wouldn't that be nice? Inward peace, purity of heart, a good conscience, how to moderate your longings and desires. How wonderful that would be too. How to become more patient, and how to submit to the will of God, and how to increase love of Jesus, how to endure pain and suffering, the loss of comfort, and how to take up the cross that Jesus says every one of his followers must pick up. So you start to see that this is a serious book when it comes to this theme that we keep coming back to time and time again of pain and suffering as not only necessary, but good. How to turn your suffering into something good. Book three is titled On Interior Consolation, and it is the longest of the four books. Proportionately, this book is asymmetrical. Books one and two, about the same length. Book three takes up a lot of space in the book as you're looking at it from the side. And it's written in the form of a dialogue between Jesus and the reader, you, or a reader that a quote-unquote disciple, right? The disciple is supposed to be you. So the disciple, the text for the disciple conversing with Jesus, of course, was written by Kempis, but that is what you are supposed to be saying and thinking and doing. Book four is the shortest of the four books, and this might surprise some of our listeners because it seems to go off on a different tangent or a different subject. It might seem like, well, this is not following a logical path, but it's on the Eucharist. Title is On the Blessed Sacrament, and it's also in the form of a dialogue between Jesus and the disciple. And it's all about how to prepare yourself to receive the body and blood of Jesus, how important it is to receive the Eucharist. So it actually encourages constant participation, constant reception of the Eucharist, which in this day and time, especially for the laity, this was a questionable sort of advice. And there's disagreement because also keeping in mind, you know, things are very different nowadays for Catholics. You go to a Catholic church and nearly everybody in the church goes to communion. That's only been happening since 1965. In the 15th century, as in the first half of the 20th century, Catholic teaching, you should not receive the Eucharist if you have committed any mortal sin and you have not yet confessed it. As a result, in the 15th century, most people received communion only, I'm talking about lay people, most lay people received communion only once a year, if that. We don't have very good statistics, but it seems that everyone was required to have communion at least once a year, preferably at Easter time. But you also had to confess your sins before receiving the Eucharist. So this advice in The Imitation of Christ is on one side of the argument that was very, it was moving on, developing and moving on. Yeah, is frequent communion good for lay people? Or is it somewhat dangerous because of the whole sin and forgiveness question? So here's a passage from Book 4 on the Eucharist. Jesus says, because remember, it's a dialogue, to receive the sacrament, quote, "You must make clean the mansions of your heart. Shut out the whole world and all its sinful din and sit as a solitary sparrow on a housetop. And in the bitterness of your soul, meditate on your transgressions." It's all about repentance, the preparation. But then the reception, you know, of course, you're going to imitate Jesus and you're going to communion frequently. You're going to be constantly, right, receiving Jesus himself in the bread, not the wine, because lay people didn't receive the wine. But this is serious business. Going to Mass daily? Yeah, sure, that would be wonderful if you do it. You'll be a much better person if you do. So you can see how this is a text that, on the one hand, is recommending a kind of piety that is unusual, new, it's a new turn, a new twist. But on the other hand, you know, some of its advice, like taking the Eucharist frequently, some churchmen might have disagreed with that advice. And there's something else to it that would later, in the 16th century, also become problematic about this book and the Devotio Moderna. And it was the fact that, you know, medieval religion was very heavily focused on the cult of the saints, the holy men and women who were in heaven as intercessors with God. And in popular piety, the saints really were everywhere, images of the saints, and people were devoted to saints. And the saints had, you know, specialties. They were you had patron saints who specialized in helping people for a specific problem or issue. So this is a very Christocentric book. And for instance, this book, if you put it alongside what were the most popular devotions in this time, it doesn't square, because it's not just the cult of the saints, but the veneration of Mary within the cult of the saints. Mary was immensely important, hugely important as an intercessor. This book is asking the reader to ignore all that. And why would this be a problem? Well, it's not calling into question the veneration of the saints, but it's telling you nothing about them. Yes, it mentions the saints. And who are the saints? They're the people who have imitated Christ. So if you see where this is going, one of the children educated by the Brethren of the Common Life, who would go on to be the most famous scholar in all of Europe in the 16th century, who was himself a deeply religious man, Erasmus of Rotterdam, he exemplified this tendency in the Devotio Moderna. And his advice in the devotional text that he wrote, which maybe we'll discuss in a future episode, the Enchiridion, or the Handbook of the Christian Soldier. His advice there constantly is, yeah, the saints are great, but what you should do is imitate their lives. Instead of going on pilgrimages to their shrines and praying to them constantly, pray to Christ. Nobody can help you more readily than Christ, even more so than the Virgin Mary. I'm talking like Erasmus right now, right? So he downplays the veneration of the saints tremendously, and also focuses on the interior spiritual life over the exterior spiritual life. Like, for instance, pilgrimages. His advice in the Enchiridion is, don't go on pilgrimages. Don't waste your money going from point A to point B on the map. God is everywhere. Jesus is with you everywhere. Stay in your house. Give your money to charity. And don't spend it on a trip to Santiago de Compostela or some other shrine. So this book is a very Catholic book. But if you look at it from that perspective, this is not 100% on the same wavelength as Catholic piety of this day and time. So some experts actually argue that this book might have had some influence on people who turned Protestant. They had read it, but they still turned Protestant.
I was about to ask you that, considering the time frame this all happened in the 16th century, were there any connections to the whole Reformation?
There are no direct connections. But, you know, Erasmus, in his own day, was blamed for having, quote-unquote, laid the egg hatched by Luther. And there's no denial. You can't deny. Yes, Erasmus had a pretty strong influence on some of the earliest Protestant reformers, especially Ulrich Zwingli in Switzerland. Very much so. Zwingli bought everything that Erasmus wrote and read it, and was very, very, very moved by Erasmus, and especially Erasmus's sometimes very humorous critiques of popular piety and the focus placed on saints. So Protestantism, all different branches of the Protestant family, they dismantle the veneration of the saints and basically follow the advice given by Erasmus, which is a similar to the advice given in the Imitation of Christ. You want to be holy? Yeah, imitate the saints. And how did they become saints? By imitating Christ. So, yeah, there is this edge to it. And it's, you know, it's a somber book. I'll be honest, the older I get, the tougher I find it. It certainly does not square with early 21st century Western culture one bit. Talk about this dichotomy, you know, the world versus the life of the spirit. Oh boy, yes. Yes, it's very different.
When you were describing the first chapter, it reminded me of something that I had just read this morning. And some of our listeners that have listened to our older shows have perhaps heard me mention last year I was reading a book called A Year with the Mystics. You go through 365 days and, you know, a little writing from a mystic and a devotion and a prayer that you can say with it. And this year, I obviously finished it last year. So this year I started another book called A Year with the Church Fathers. And just today I read one from St. Leo the Great, or Pope Leo the First. And it's about not putting value on the world and putting value on Christ. And, you know, this goes back to this third century.
Leo is 5th century. He went out to meet Attila, to turn him away from sacking Rome. One of the things that Leo is known for. So yeah, he's very early. So it's church father.
Very early, but it's interesting because here, you know, and I'll just read a short piece of it. Here he writes in a sermon, "And so, dear friends, I don't tell you or advise you to despise God's works." He's talking about the world and the creation, yes, and the things, yeah, or to think there is anything against your faith in what the good God has made good, but use every kind of creature and everything this world is equipped with reasonably and moderately. Then he goes on to say, so because we are born for the present and reborn for the future, let us not give ourselves up to transient goods, but to eternal ones. So it's a very, this has been going on since the, or this mindset has been around since the early days of the church.
Oh, very much so. So here's a passage from book one. It sounds like an echo of the one that you just read. Live on earth as a pilgrim and a stranger, unconcerned with the world's business. Let your heart remain free and lifted up to God, for you have not here a lasting city. It's a little harsher, I think, a little harder. But yeah, it's the same thought, basically. This is temporary. Focus on something else and don't put all your eggs into the world basket, more or less.
Well, this is a topic that we've discussed many times in previous episodes, considering mysticism has such a strong or such a devotion to asceticism, to depriving yourself. And that just goes completely against 21st century and late 20th century philosophy, where you're taught to center on yourself. And as we read from the early days of the church and to the 15th and 16th centuries, and the mystics that we've talked about, it's all been about doing the exact opposite, is to take the focus off of yourself and put the focus on Christ.
That's right. On Christ and neighbor. I should add that. Although the neighbor part doesn't appear all that frequently in the Imitation of Christ, but it is there. Yeah, very much so. Here's the first paragraph of book two, which is, you know, considerations for leading an interior life. Our Lord says, the kingdom of God is in your midst, Luke 17:21. The only way your soul will find rest is to turn to God with your whole heart and abandon this wretched world. Learn to despise exterior things and give your attention to the inner things. Then you will see the kingdom of God come within you. Certainly doesn't fit very comfortably with, you know, our dominant culture in the West. We're not encouraged to view the world as wretched. And actually, that's some of the criticisms. Today, I spent some time hunting for criticism that has been made of this book. And actually, there's a very prominent 20th century Catholic theologian, Hans Urs von Balthasar, German, who had pretty serious criticisms of the way in which this book sort of sucks the joy, more or less. I'm paraphrasing him. He would never say that. You know, I'm just paraphrasing. This book doesn't have enough joy in it or enough attention paid to making the world a better place for everybody. And I have to say that it's missing from the Imitation of Christ. It doesn't ask you to become holy, to be in the world, but not of the world, explicitly, only implicitly.
I think you also have to take into consideration the culture of the time.
Right.
Where the world was a very harsh place for the vast majority of the people that lived in it.
It was horrible.
So
from our perspective, absolutely terrifying.
So turning your back on the world for the majority of the people was turning your back on misery, on suffering, on toil and pain. So it really wasn't that big of an ask to put it in modern terms.
This is why I felt comfortable calling this a self-help book. If your life is constantly filled with all sorts of pain and suffering, and, you know, modern medicine, medical solutions we have to physical problems, ailments nowadays, most of what we rely on was not available then. We've talked about this before.
Now, anyone who's read your memoirs, Carlos, knows that you have a very special connection to this book. Can you tell us about it?
Oh, yes, for those who have not read or who forgot, because, you know, it's not a main theme. But the thing is that when I left Cuba without my parents, you were only allowed to take two changes of clothing, one coat, one hat, and one book, nothing else. So, of course, my parents picked out a book for me, and my brother, we both got the same book. We each got our own copy. The Imitation of Christ. I was 11 years old. My brother was 14. Imagine all the stuff in this book. I'm going to read some passages to give our listeners the full effect. There was a, let's call it a superstition in Spanish culture about this book, which is similar to something that Protestants do with the Bible, which is, if you're having a problem of any kind, you want divine help, open the book at random, and with your eyes closed, you know, put your finger on a page, which actually is how Augustine converted to Christianity, pretty much. This is a very, very ancient practice, ancient Christian practice. It's an ancient pre-Christian practice. Is you know, you get your divine guidance somewhat randomly. So I was told by my parents, oh, you know, you're going to be all by yourself. You're going to be facing difficult situations. Anytime that you're having a problem, just open your Kempis. You'll get an answer. You'll get help from God directly. But, oh boy, I tried that repeatedly. And then I would, you know, I'm having a problem. I'm living in a home, a foster home, full of juvenile delinquents. And they're horrible. They do horrible things to me. So let's say I open it. Now, I just opened it at random here, and I put my finger on this passage. Christ's whole life was a cross and martyrdom. And do you expect pleasure and enjoyment for yourself? You make a grave mistake if you look for anything other than suffering. For this mortal life of ours is full of misery and surrounded with crosses. I would shut the book and put it away. And I did that repeatedly. So I outgrew all my clothes. I outgrew my hat. The only thing I had left that physically connected me with my parents was this book in Spanish, in a 17th century Spanish translation. So I kept doing this, and this book scared me until I came close to being like 14 years old. And I was having fairly typical 14-year-old difficulties, except mine were multiplied by the fact that, you know, I didn't have my parents. We were poor. But I also started to realize, and this goes back to what we talked about before, I would open it at random, and then I'd get these very frightful passages for an 11-year-old or 12 or 13-year-old. Pretty scary stuff. Oh my God, you know, suffering is good for you. And started to make sense to me, given my situation. I used to get these panic attacks anytime that I came to whatever foster home I was living in. If there was no one in the house, I'd have these crushing anxiety attacks that I didn't know what they were. But it was just that I felt completely alone, and I was going to be alone forever, that all my adults had abandoned me and stuff like that. This book helped me get out of that in a very direct way, because I took his advice seriously. And I came to realize, yes, it's not this book that's scary, and it's not Jesus on the cross that's scary. It's the world that's scary. And I kind of see obliquely my older brother, who never, ever stopped thinking about everything he had lost and everything that our family had lost in Cuba and the, you know, the pain and suffering that so many of our family went through. It was killing him, metaphorically, all of this pain, but he never could get over it. But I managed to do so. I really couldn't have cared less about anything that my family lost or that I had lost, including my comic book collection. You know, I had a number two Batman comic book in Spanish. That'd probably be worth, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars now. Oh my God. Well, believe it or not, I thought about that pretty often. Am I ever going to get my comic books back? It sounds silly, but it's an 11-year-old, 12-year-old. This book turned me around, and I took much of his advice very, very seriously. Because, in fact, that was my reality. You know, crosses were inescapable. This book helped me tremendously when I moved to Chicago with my brother, and our mother had arrived in the U.S. and she couldn't find any work. And I went to work full time when I was a freshman in high school as a dishwasher at the Conrad Hilton Hotel in Chicago. And I had to ride the subway from way far north side of Chicago downtown to the Hilton Hotel. It was fine going there at 3 p.m. after school, but I had to come home at 2 a.m. every night, walking through some pretty, as my kids would say, sketchy neighborhoods. And I went back and started reading this book over and over again. And, you know, not doing the open the page at random thing, but like, you know, actually reading the book and paying attention to what it had to say. And I say it rescued me. I actually wrote an essay for this book. The title of the book is The Book That Changed My Life. And different authors contributed essays about what book had changed their life. And I wrote an essay on how this book changed my life for the better. Now that I'm an old man and I open it, you know, and I see these passages with a distance of time, you know, 60 some years later, this is somewhat harsh. But in fact, it's true. It's true. And it's good to have a way of handling suffering, pain, disappointments by saying, well, this is only temporary. And I should not be so invested in these things. So is it a mystical book? Well, I think it can be. I think it can lead, you know, step number one. What is the step number one in the mystical path? Purgation, cleansing, letting go, as Meister Eckhart would say. Gelassenheit, letting go of material things. If you end up in a one-bedroom or a studio apartment with no furniture in a strange country, and you don't know if you'll ever see your family again, this book can help. Or if you end up in a house full of, what's another word? Youth felons who belong to gangs and are constantly trying to get you involved in their gang fights. And at that time, the youth felons in my foster home were in the Burger King gang on Calle Ocho or 8th Street in Little Havana. There were two gangs, the McDonald's gang and the Burger King gang. And they're always fighting each other and tried to get me and my brother to. And whenever we said no, we'd get beaten up pretty badly.
Well, I think it was a wise choice by your parents to give you and your brother that book.
Oh, yeah. Yes. How much foresight was involved? You know, there was a spiritual dimension to the book with that kind of silly. I still think it was silly. I thought it was silly then. I still think it's silly. You know, open it at random and see what you get. The book was not made for that. It was made to be read from cover to cover and to be taken very seriously. But yeah, they meant well, and it was a great choice that they made.
Well, I have to say that I've been guilty on many of occasions of just opening a Bible at random and placing a finger and reading in times of trouble. Mm-hmm. Kind of hoping to find some communication.
Yes. And actually, I do that too. I have done that with the Bible, and especially the Psalms. Because I think the Psalms are the most beautiful prayers that anybody could say. Many of them. So, you know, I open the Psalms at random, and I swear, this is true. If we were in a courtroom, right, I'd be putting my hand on the Bible and saying, yes, everything I'm saying is true. For some reason, no matter which edition of the Bible or which translation, whether it's in English or Spanish or some other language, so frequently when I open the Psalms at random, I get the psalm that says, Moab is my wash basin. Upon Philistia, I cast my shoe. It's almost as if God is telling me, don't do this.
That's happened to me in the past as well. But it's a fascinating book. I've only read pieces of it. I've never done the cover to cover. And I certainly, after this episode, I think I really do want to make the effort to read it cover to cover. And hopefully I can get just a tiny fraction of the inspiration and help that you received from it. But for me, it's clear, and I think for our listeners, it should be clear that even though this book does not contain visions and ecstasies and levitations, it is a preparation for that. And as you mentioned earlier in the podcast, without this book, you wouldn't have the mysticism of many of the mystics that we've talked about on the podcast.
Yes.
So we know now how many mystics prepared for their mystical journeys. What are we going to talk about on the next episode?
Well, we're going to stay close in time to this book, pretty close. There's a mystic, Maria Maddalena de Pazzi, who belonged to one of the most powerful families in Renaissance Italy, Baroque Italy. And she is very unusual. And the reason I've thought of moving on to her is that what she did to the extreme was to do precisely what the advice was in Ludolf of Saxony's Life of Christ. She put herself there, and she would have these conversations with Jesus, and the nuns would follow her around and take down what she was saying. But, well, we'll get to the details next time. She's another example of someone who has a very, very active kind of public ecstatic life.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And I want to thank you for sharing your take on The Imitation of Christ and how it has affected you personally. And I truly do appreciate that. And I'm sure our listeners do as well. So until the next time, thank you for listening to the Christian Mysticism Podcast.
If you have any questions for Dr. Eyre, you'll find our email address in the show notes. Just send it over and we'll try to answer it in a future episode. And don't forget to click the subscribe button so you don't miss the next episode of the Christian Mysticism Podcast.